Veterans Stand with Standing Rock, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Meet the veterans who joined the protesters fighting the Dakota Access Pipeline. People like John Shirley, who fought in the first Gulf War.
I never thought I would be doing this on American soil, protecting the American people from their own government. I never thought that would happen, you know.
And Brandy King, a Native American who served in Iraq.
Seeing my indigenous brothers and sisters be able to stand up with pride provides a healing for me.
We'll have an update from North Dakota, plus how singing to four-year-olds in Pennsylvania changed the life of this refugee from South Sudan.
I would jump with them, get silly like them, you know, working with the kids, you just get down at their level and mess with them.
That's all ahead today here on The World. Glad you could be here this Monday. We are still processing the big news out of North Dakota last night, the decision by the Army Corps of Engineers to block construction of a key part of the Dakota Access Pipeline, the one that was supposed to be drilled beneath a section of the Missouri River. We'll be hearing more in a few minutes about the Corps' decision specifically, but there is no question that this is a major victory for the protesters who for months have been gathered at the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. They've objected to the possibility that the massive pipeline could contaminate the reservation's water supply. That's why the protesters have been calling themselves water protectors. Over the weekend, perhaps a turning point at the protest camp, a large number of military veterans, many of them natives, arrived to protect the protesters themselves. The World's Jasmine Garz is just outside Standing Rock right now. So walk us through this, Jasmine. You arrived at the camp on Friday. What was the mood then?
Marco, when we arrived, the mood was kind of grim and wary about what was going to happen in the next coming days. You know, there had been snowfall. This heavy blanket of snow was over the camp, and temperatures were already dropping. They were expected to drop even more in the next coming days. And there was a palpable anxiety over Monday, which is when the Army Corps gave the deadline for campers and protesters to remove themselves from the area.
Right. And for the people who support the pipeline project, I imagine a lot of frustration on their part.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the people who support the pipeline say, you know, we did everything legally. We've dotted all our I's, crossed all our T's. They feel like the protesters came in kind of at the 11th hour. And like it's going to cost a lot of money to reroute this. You know, the people who support the pipeline are also talking about job creation. And finally, you know, we've talked to some locals who are, in fact, kind of tired of thousands of protesters honing in on this area.
Now, Jasmine, the story you're about to tell us is it's all about this weekend and all of these military veterans who started to pour in. I know a lot of them had been there for months, but many others started arriving en masse this weekend. And you met some of them, right?
Yeah. The first veteran I met when I got into the Standing Rock camp was a Navajo man, John Shirley. He's a veteran of the Persian Gulf War, the first Persian Gulf War.
Yeah, I'm here to basically be a human shield.
John Shirley is a veteran of the first Persian Gulf War. He came all the way from Arizona to guard protesters. I meet him at the entrance to the sprawling camp where protesters have clashed with National Guard and local police in recent weeks. And that's when veterans like Shirley decided to come to help people in the camp, to be that human shield.
Stand there, close my eyes, and take whatever comes at me, you know, as long as I can block and deflect whatever it may be, you know. That's the way we was trained.
Like many veterans, he felt outraged at the way protesters were being treated by police. And he was also frustrated that native lands and resources could be endangered by the pipeline.
I never thought I would be doing this on American soil. Protecting the American people from their own government. I never thought that would happen, you know.
Several thousand veterans felt the same way and poured into the camp over the weekend.
No direct action will be taken.
At a Saturday night meeting in a warehouse outside Standing Rock, veterans are instructed to be nonviolent.
We will not instigate.
They were told to spread the orders among themselves. No direct confrontation and nothing that could harm the cause. At the warehouse, there's still a sense that the pipeline is inevitable. The message is, if we lose, we put up a good fight. And again, elders and leaders stress a peaceful resistance.
Fighting for peace is a lot harder than, I mean, anybody could pull the trigger.
Brandy King, a Nakota veteran of Iraq, says nonviolence, non-confrontation, is challenging to a warrior.
Actually being peaceful and fighting for that, that takes a warrior. That takes a strong person to be peaceful.
I meet Brandy on the campgrounds outside of her teepee. She's stocky and she has a rough demeanor with a melancholy, heavy-lidded gaze. She grew up on a Montana reservation and only left to join the military. She served for 8 years.
And that's all I, you know, grew to know, learning how to fight.
She returned from Iraq with severe PTSD.
I wanted to take my life. I tried to take my life.
She came home to a system that wasn't prepared to cope with women vets like her.
They weren't prepared for the amount of women who were combat veterans that were going to be coming in with wounds and with PTSD.
Brandy says after 10 years of not knowing what to do with herself, it was here, at Standing Rock, that she finally began to heal.
This, seeing people together, seeing people support each other, seeing that provides healing for me. Seeing my indigenous brothers and sisters be able to stand up with pride provides a healing for me.
But it still wasn't an easy decision, coming here, knowing she might have to face off with fellow military on the other side of this fight. At the end of the day, she figured,
if I was willing to die for this government, I was willing to die for this country, if I was willing to die for North Dakota, because they're part of the Constitution too, you know, if I was willing to die for every single person here, then give me some peace. Allow me to live for my ancestors. Allow me to create a better path for the ones that are coming, for my nieces and nephews and the unborn. Let me be a part of that.
She prays on it. That prayer gets answered on Sunday night. It's absolutely frigid under a crisp blue sky when the announcement comes.
Today, the Department of Army, Joe Allen Darcy, contacted me and said the Corps of Engineers is going to deny the easement.
In other words, the Army Corps will not give permission for the pipeline to go under the Missouri River. I go find Brandy King. She's right outside of her teepee, away from the crowd.
You prayed to experience this, but when it actually happened, I don't know what to feel. I really don't. I can't even come up with the words right now.
She's crying with joy.
There wasn't any violence. There was no weapons. Just feel that spiritual reinforcement from the veterans, the warriors, all of those who fought Vietnam, Desert Storm, Afghanistan and Iraq. All of those that brought everything that they had, everything that they took to every battle. Every battleground, but this was the spiritual battleground.
The crowd roars and sings, and Brandy is speechless.
The world's Jasmine Garr is back with me on the line from just outside Standing Rock. Some people happy with the decision, not everyone, though. What's been the response from the people who backed Energy Transfer Partners and wanted the pipeline to be run under the Missouri River?
Look, there's definitely a sense on both sides of this fight that it is not over yet, especially because the incoming Trump administration has expressed its support for projects like this. And, you know, Energy Transfer Partners released a very strongly worded statement regarding this. And they said, quote, "The White House's directive today to the Corps for further delay is just the latest in a series of overt and transparent political actions by an administration which has abandoned the rule of law." So pretty strong words.
I mean, you'd think the good news would have cleared out the camp, but the protesters are still there. Do they see this as a long-term victory?
No, I think yesterday when the victory was announced on Sunday night, there was jubilee. I mean, it was an absolute explosion of joy. It was a celebration. Even then, you heard especially Native elders saying, let's see what happens. And I think as the hours pass by and there is a very firm and unflinching response from those who support the pipeline, it becomes clearer and clearer that this fight is hardly over. And a lot of protesters are saying, yeah, we're not going anywhere.
The world's Jasmine Garr is just outside Standing Rock, North Dakota. Thank you very much for bringing us up to speed, Jasmine.
Thank you, Marco.
We have a video of one of the Native veterans Jasmine spoke with. Brandy King explains why, as she says, she's fighting for peace. You can see that video at PRI.org. As Jasmine noted, the debate over the Dakota Access Pipeline project isn't over yet, but that decision by the Army Corps of Engineers does put completing the project on hold for now. Specifically, the Corps refused to grant an easement for the pipeline to go beneath a section of the Missouri River. It's a dammed-up area of the river known as Lake Oahe. So how did the Army Corps make its decision? I asked Jim Murphy about that. He's an environmental lawyer with the National Wildlife Federation.
I wasn't totally surprised. I was very pleased about the decision. You know, there are very strong arguments that Lake Oahe is a vulnerable area. It's obviously a very important area to the tribe for both drinking water and irrigation. You know, there was pretty clear indication that a lot of the potential impacts to the lake were not adequately looked at, both from a natural resource and a tribal perspective. So I think it's the right decision, and I don't think it was surprising. They've been giving these pipelines much more scrutiny than they were given in the past.
Does the Army Corps ever take on political considerations when making these decisions? For example, I mean, U.S. veterans are at the Standing Rock camp. This could also be seen as a last chance for Obama to do something on this pipeline.
Yeah, under the law, they're supposed to look at the facts and the legal requirements. I think there's a strong argument under the facts and the legal requirements that this is the right decision. You know, obviously, you know, all federal agencies and the presidency are aware of the political dynamics at play. But I think the legal basis here and the factual basis here are strong to support this decision. I think it matters that the people and the tribes have gathered together, you know, and pointed out some of those deficiencies in the process. And I think that probably help lead to this decision, but I think ultimately it's the right decision under the law and the facts.
Something like 90% of the Dakota Access Pipeline has already been built. What about the timing of this decision?
Yeah, I think the risks here in terms of building a pipeline without all your approvals falls on the company. I think the company was well aware that it didn't have this easement and it chose to plow ahead anyways. And I think probably tried to put some pressure on the Corps to make this decision inevitable. I think it really kind of speaks to the Corps that they resisted that pressure and again looked at the law and also the voices that were coming from the people about the importance of this resource. And again, the risk here I think fall to the company. If this causes the company hardship, it certainly was an avoidable one.
Any thought that this good news would clear out the protest camp? Wrong. The protesters are still there despite a heavy blizzard. What is keeping them there?
Obviously, I think this is a pretty rare coming together of both tribes and supporters of tribes to, stand up and give some voice to, to voices that haven't been heard in some of these decisions. My guess is that they're probably, waiting to make sure that this really sticks.
Yeah, so final question. Can this decision be overruled by Donald Trump when he becomes president in January? Like, if he wanted, could he dismiss the Army Corps of Engineers' plans and return to Plan A by Energy Transfer Partners to run the pipeline under this part of the Missouri River?
He certainly could. I mean, I think it would face legal challenge, but a new administration and a new Corps could, revisit this decision. And the lack of analysis of impacts from spill and the contamination that comes with a spill to Lake Oahe and other downstream resources is very real. That's an analysis that needs to take place. So, I think he's got to, obviously, I think, weigh the facts and the law the way the Obama administration did. And hopefully he'll come to a similar conclusion, although there's indication that he may not.
Jim Murphy is an environmental lawyer with the National Wildlife Federation. Thank you very much.
Great. Thanks.
This is The World. If you're teaching girls in Afghanistan, you're not just facing the usual daily challenges from pupils. You're also facing the threats of people who don't want girls educated, like the Taliban. But that hasn't stopped Sakina Yakubi. She set up a network of schools for young Afghan women, secretly at first, then out in the open. Yakubi says she first got a visit from the Taliban when she ran a school for Afghan girls in a Pakistani refugee camp.
all of a sudden I was in the office and these people sort of ran into the office and everybody was running away. And I said, what's going on? They said, we have to hide because these people are coming and asking us why we have this program. So, of course, as a leader of organization, as somebody who really are responsible for hundreds and hundreds of people, I was scared. I didn't know what's going to happen right now. But the point was that you have to take the initiative as a leader and you have to try to stand strong and just go forward. So I told them, no, I'm not going to hide and I'm going to talk to them. So I went there and I stand up and I said, what do you want? And they shouted me and they said, oh, well, don't you know that education is banned for Afghan women and Afghan girls inside Afghanistan? And I just smiled. I had full hijab. Only my eyes were showing up. And I just said, don't you want your wife and your children to be healthy? We are teaching them health education.
Yeah, and what did he say?
He just said, you don't teach. I said, how about teaching Quran? Don't you want your children and your wife to learn how to read Quran? Quran is a holy book. We all believe we are Muslim. Aren't we Muslim? And when I said that, it was a different story. And they look at each other and they said in Pashto, leave her alone. She knows what she's doing. Forget about it. And then again, I insist. I said, please come have a cup of tea with me. Then they just came and they took a sip and they left. You have to really integrate with these people and try to convince them that Islam is a religion of education.
As far as this moment where you were talking to the Taliban, you're teaching these refugee girls mathematics and how to read in this school, but what about the Quran part? Were you teaching them about the Quran as well?
Yes, but you know what kind of Quran we were teaching? Not just root memorization. We were teaching them the meaning of the Quran. So we were teaching subject of mathematics, social science, all the classes we were teaching. And also we were teaching Quran. And we were teaching how to be equal, how to help your neighbor, how to have respect for each other. These are the issues that in Quran, if you read the text of Quran, these are the issues that in Quran, justice is a part of it. Gender equality is a part of it. Human rights is a part of it. Democracy is a part of it. These are the issues that is all included, integrated into Quran text.
So what did you take away from that whole encounter with the Taliban? Because, I mean, you managed somehow to get through to the quote-unquote enemy. What did you learn about?
Well, first of all, if you are an entrepreneur, I'm a social entrepreneur, and I take risk all the time. And so you, in this kind of area, you have to take risk and communicate in a way that you really want to those people listen to your reason. And through that experience, it taught me to really face Taliban many, many times. It wasn't one time. Many times I came to a situation like that, and I learned how to get away from it and really go after my objective, which is education. And you know, today, every time I turn my face sideways or back, I see my students are doctor, engineer, lawyer, teacher, and they are blooming. And I enjoy that very, very much.
So, and these are young women who came from the countryside.
They are young women who are from rural area. They are young men who are from rural area. They are people who really never had opportunity to go to school.
Sakina Yaqubi there. She defied the Taliban and set up a network of schools for Afghan girls. Let's go now to a very different educational setting, a daycare center in Erie, Pennsylvania. This one, though, is a place where the kids get a chance to hear children's songs from all over the globe. That's in thanks in part to refugees who settled in Erie. Erica Barris has our story.
Marta Sam is surrounded by really energetic four-year-olds. She's at St. Martin's Daycare in Erie, guiding the kids as they sing and dance. Marta sings in Arabic, then English, then a Congolese song, and then to monkeys jumping on the bed. The kids follow her cues, they scream sing, they dance, they call out their favorite songs. Marta is used to this.
When they see me in the classroom, they say, Miss Marta, can we do this? Miss Marta, can we sing this? Miss Marta, can we jump? Yeah, I will jump with them, get silly like them, you know. Working with the kids, you just get down in their level and, you know, do mess with them. Yeah.
Marta is from South Sudan. 13 years ago, she came to Erie as part of the first wave of thousands of refugees who resettled in this small Rust Belt city. Marta works here because of a program dreamed up by Kelly Armour, a folklorist and educator at the Erie Art Museum. Kelly's from Erie, but had spent time studying traditional song in Kenya and Tanzania. When she noticed refugees resettling in Erie, she had an idea.
Wow, could it be that there are refugee women that would love to work with small children? And could it be that they know lots of songs and they know how to use songs with kids?
It turned out they did. And in some cases, for women like Victoria Angelo, who's also from South Sudan, the songs were all she brought to the U.S.
I was not able to bring anything, no dishes. I just ran with my kids without even clothing. What I actually brought with me was the songs.
But in some ways, the songs represented everything.
Simba la 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 la, Simba la 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 la, Simba la la, Simba la la, Simba, Simba, Simbo.
It's just expressing our feelings, our happiness, our sadness, the war going on, expressing the season when there is heavy rain, when there is drought.
Kelly Armour, the folklorist, followed through on her hunch. She got funding to train women like Victoria so they could get jobs in childcare. Then, just as she did in Africa, she collected and translated their songs. The program, combining job training and musical tradition, has been so successful, the museums released a CD.
There's one song from Africa, from the Acholi people, which is a song that you use when a child begins to toddle.
Henry Agenda, Henry Mutiti, Chochochi.
It is a way to call the child to toddle to you, and then you sing to that child to turn around, and then somebody else sings to that child.
Kelly's archived nearly 100 songs from almost as many countries and cultures. There are songs about everything. Here's a Nepali song about climbing mango trees at recess to pick ripe fruit.
Hera hera satio apakeza antipika.
But at the end of the song, the bell rings and you don't get the mango. And I think of that as kind of, well, there you go. There's an eternal truth. Recess will never be long enough. And sometimes you don't get time to eat that mango.
And then there are songs that just get you through the day with toddlers. Victoria's changing diapers at the daycare. She's been here long enough that nowadays she doesn't just sing the songs of her native land. For The World, Erica Barris in Erie, Pennsylvania.
Check out some more of those children's songs at PRI.org. This is The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. President-elect Trump upset China by speaking directly with Taiwan's president on the phone. So much for protocol.
There's a good case to be made that the U.S. maybe ought to drop the whole elaborate fiction, maybe recognize Taiwan that formerly is an independent state, but this wasn't the right way to go about it.
So now what? Find out. Still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. You could be forgiven for thinking Europe is coming unstuck these days. First, there was the Brexit, when British voters chose to leave the European Union. Then there's been the rise of parties opposed to European integration in several countries, including France, the Netherlands, and Germany. And now this weekend, voters in Italy turned against their Prime Minister, Matteo Renzi. So Renzi, a pro-EU leader, submitted his resignation. But the EU still has a lot of life in it, according to Richard Parker. He's a lecturer in public policy at Harvard's Shorenstein Center. Parker says the vote in Italy was not a full-out rejection of the European Union.
It wasn't quite as simple as a populist vote, although there's a lot of pointing to the relative success of the Five Star Movement and the Northern League, both of which have said that they would hold referenda on Italian participation in the EU. We need to locate it as a sign that this crisis of legitimacy that is haunting not just European but Western governments is ongoing, but that this is not a final blow in the end of Western civilization as we know it, or even the EU as we've known it.
So let's look at Austria, where over the weekend, a very different signal. Voters rejected the candidacy of right-wing nationalist Norbert Hofer. Mm-hmm. Is this a contradiction of the trend of nationalists holding sway over globalists, or just a fluke in the trend?
You have to remember that Hofer is the representative of a party that was founded by a former SS officer, so it carries with it a specific taint. I think that if you want to understand what's going on in Europe, you need to understand several things, one of which is that the older center-left parties that had been based on unions and labor and a substantial part of the white-collar professional classes have suffered severely over time. They've been hit both from the left, where green parties have emerged, and also further left parties like Der Link in Germany. And at the same time, they have lost narrative coherence for their voters. That is, there was a story to tell in the post-war period of economic recovery and deepening of political democratization. That political democratization process has been completed on the national level, but has been replaced by all these questions of a continental governance process, that is the EU, that is less than fully democratic in a number of ways. The second is that the long economic recovery that went on from the 40s to the 70s that increased prosperity for all has, just as in the United States, reversed itself. And that goes to the heart of what is both the European problem and also the American problem.
Yeah, I mean, at the same time, as you describe Austria's vote, it sounds like it's very specific with this right-winger being defeated. It also seems to tip to this whole idea that Austrians may be standing up for the idea of Europe. Do they care about Europe?
Everyone in Europe cares about Europe. I think we in America actually have to care about Europe even more. And I'd pull the lens back and say, look, the West is in a fundamental period of shifting global economic power to the East, to China, but not China alone. That means that the next 50 to 100 years are going to see fundamental shifts in global power as global economic power leaves the North Atlantic. We want a unified and strong Europe on our side, negotiating those changes, rather than a fragmented Europe in which no one country is larger than the California economy and therefore can be easily picked off or separated out like sheep from a flock as these negotiations occur.
Yeah, you say we should want the European Union, but do you think the incoming administration of Donald Trump wants it?
Well, you know, I mean, Donald Trump bills himself as a populist, but his new Secretary of the Treasury is a former Goldman Sachs executive. And the head of the European Central Bank is a former Goldman Sachs executive. The about-to-be retired head of the European Governing Board is about to join Goldman Sachs. Whether Trump wants to toy with Europe, as he did a week or so ago when he suggested that Nigel Farage, who led UKIP, become the British ambassador to the horror of almost the entire British nation, I suspect that he will toss off lots of ideas that on the face of them look like he's opposed to a unified Europe. But I think Mnuchin and others around the Secretary of the Treasury, and certainly Janet Yellen and the Fed, will be quite vigorous and noisy about warning President Trump that to push Europe toward further dissolution is to risk the deepest of American political and geoeconomic interests.
Richard, 10-second answer. In a decade, the EU, still a thing?
Absolutely. It's still going to be a thing. I think it's going to actually have deepened in terms of fiscal policy. I think the question is how now center-left parties and the intelligent parts of the center-right can come together to create a real democratic responsiveness to voters. I think this is a period of danger, but I think it's a period of enormous opportunity.
Richard Parker, a lecturer in public policy at Harvard's Shorenstein Center. Thank you very much.
Good to talk with you, Marco.
Another showdown in Europe involves housing. You see, there's a shortage of affordable housing in many places, especially for rent. And critics put some of the blame for that on websites like Airbnb. They say these sites allow landlords to fill their apartments with lucrative short-term rentals instead of more affordable long-term ones. Authorities in Germany's capital, Berlin, decided to do something about that. They've enacted a law that slaps stiff regulations on Airbnb and similar companies. Fergus O'Sullivan went to Berlin to report on this for the Atlantic's City Lab project.
Well, what it hopes to accomplish is to stop private apartments being flushed out of the permanent rental markets and being used entirely for tourist accommodation, because there's a housing shortage in Berlin and people in the city fear that large tracts of the city are basically being taken over by the likes of Airbnb and Wimdu and these other home share platforms. So the idea of the law is to make it difficult or impossible to exploit that sector at the expense of ordinary Berliners.
Yeah. So what are the penalties if you are a homeowner and you do a private home share online?
Well, the highest potential penalty is a fine of 100,000 euros. So
wow.
It's quite substantial. Yes, but it should be made clear that it's a very long process that is required. It takes about 1 or 2 years to go through in order to get to that point. And that's the maximum they can ask. So it wouldn't necessarily mean that everyone that is caught out would be paying 100,000 euros.
Still, I mean, if you do, if you were to be fined at the high end of things, I mean, that's would seem to be kind of inhibiting. And the goal of this law is to prioritize residents over tourists, right? So is it working, this law?
Well, it's too early to say. I mean, it came in May. And as I said, that takes about 1 to 2 years to process just a single complaint. So far, there's not much evidence that it's eradicating it by any means. I mean, if you go to a Berlin Airbnb map, you'll find offers all over the place. It has brought it down off its highest peak, and there seems to be some evidence that it's succeeding in flushing out professional landlords, that is, people who aren't using their own homes, aren't using their own, even their second homes, and actually have multiple apartments in the city. But certainly, if you went to the Airbnb map for Berlin, you would be very surprised to hear that there was a law preventing that kind of rental.
Yeah, right. I mean, there are apartments available in Berlin right now on Airbnb.
Yes, all over.
What do the people who own apartments and rent them out on Airbnb and these other platforms, what do they think of this law?
Well, obviously they're against it, but there's something very important to say here, that Berlin and Germany in general, and especially Berlin, is very different from the United States and from Britain, in that the overwhelming majority of people rent their apartments. Owner-occupiers are very much in a minority. Therefore, all laws in the country tend to be skewed more in the favor of tenants than of owners. So, obviously, homeowners are not happy about this at all. Nonetheless, the reason that their kind of concerns are being overruled is that the greatest majority of the electorate in Berlin actually rent.
Mm. So is there a way that we can kind of extrapolate what this response to Airbnb in Berlin suggests for other cities around the world, cities here in the U.S.?
Yes. Well, that's a good question. Certainly, lots of cities around the world are trying different ways of controlling the vacation rental market. And Berlin is an example of going very, very hard. They're going harder than other people. They are succeeding possibly in scaring away some of these large-scale professional investors who want to get 10, 20 apartments. It seems to be working on that, and that arguably is the main target of the law. Certainly, what it also tells us is that if there is safety in numbers for people letting out their houses or their flats on Airbnb, then people will still break any rules that are trying to prevent them, because they know that ultimately they'll get away with it.
The Atlantic's City Lab reporter, Fergus O'Sullivan, thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure.
We've told you lots on the show this year about the dilemma faced by many Syrian refugees trapped in Greece, thousands of them stuck in the country after European authorities basically blocked them there. But it's not just Syrians who are seeking asylum in Europe. Gene Carstensen recently met some young Somali journalists at the Moria refugee camp on the island of Lesbos. Here's their story.
Journalists aren't allowed inside Moria, so I probably wouldn't have met Kamal Hassan if it hadn't been for the fire. In September, refugees protesting the horrible conditions in the camp set much of it ablaze. The 4,000 people living inside were forced to evacuate and spilled into the roads surrounding the camp. I was in the crowd when someone tapped me on the shoulder. A young man with friendly dark eyes introduced himself as Kamal Hassan. He told me he was a journalist from Somalia. He and two other Somali journalists were seeking asylum. They'd all been targeted by the extremist group Al-Shabaab in Mogadishu. But now they were stuck in Moria, and he urgently wanted to tell me their story. A few days later, I pick up Kamal and Kothar Adraman at the camp. Kothar is only 21. She's been a journalist since she was 16. Kothar doesn't speak any English, so Kamal tells me about her long journey from Somalia to Greece.
No, with a friend.
With a friend.
Yeah.
All the way from Mogadishu.
Yeah.
Oh, so far.
Kothar built and runs her own news website. She's the only female journalist in Somalia to have done so. She even has her own theme song. Kothar is young, but she's tough. Al-Shabaab militants are known for targeting journalists in their homes. So she lived in a safe house with other female journalists. She only saw her mother once or twice a year.
It was like 3 years minimum. I don't meet with my family home. I was with the friends.
And this is because it was too dangerous for her to go home.
It's like she is fear about the Shabaab. She can't stay with her family because they will come to kill her.
Somalia is one of the most dangerous places in the world to be a journalist. 30 have been killed there in the past 4 years alone. Kamal was also threatened by Al-Shabaab. They attempted to shoot him when he tried to visit his mother in Mogadishu.
So they have your name and where you walk, where you live, where is your family. All the time they are looking you, but you don't know.
So he fled too. On the dinghy from Turkey to Lesbos, he met the third Somali journalist, Yasin Abukar. Yasin was kidnapped by Al-Shabaab twice, barely escaping with his life. Then last year, Al-Shabaab bombed the house where Yasin's wife and child were staying.
The latest, while I flee, they throw me in a bomb. My baby boy, they think that I was in here.
Yasin wasn't there, but his wife was injured and his baby boy was killed. Kothar, Yasin, and Kamal hope to return to Somalia one day and continue working as journalists. But for now, they're stranded in Moria, awaiting their asylum hearings. Under the EU-Turkey deal on migrants, they can't leave Lesbos until their cases are decided. It's unlikely, though, that anyone other than Syrians will be granted asylum. In spite of these obstacles, they remain hopeful authorities might help them. Meanwhile, Kothar's ambitions haven't flagged a bit. When she can get a good internet connection, she still manages to update her news website every once in a while from the camp with video reports from other Somali journalists. One day she wants to be famous.
Still, I like to be a journalist. So, and I need to publish everything is going on the world. And I need to give understand my people what is going on the world.
For the world, Jean Carstensen, Lesbos, Greece.
Jean's reporting in Greece is supported by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It's been a pretty intense few days for U.S.-China relations. You could say President-elect Donald Trump started it all on Friday when he spoke directly with the president of Taiwan. That conversation breached nearly 40 years of carefully crafted U.S. policy toward China, which considers Taiwan a part of its territory. China protested the call, then Trump went further. He took to Twitter yesterday, challenging China on hot-button issues like the value of its currency and its territorial claims in the South China Sea. So today, China sent Trump a clear message, a front-page editorial in the People's Daily, the official mouthpiece of the ruling Communist Party. It warned Trump he was risking a confrontation with China. Kaiser Guo is a China analyst. So first of all, Kaiser, just sift through the details regarding this phone call between Trump and Taiwan's president. Was it spontaneous or had it been months in the works, as some people have suggested? And who called whom?
Well, we really don't know yet. The Washington Post is reporting that it was months in the work, but we still don't know how well Trump himself really understood the complexities of the whole arrangement that we had with Beijing and with Taipei. We don't know who, if any, of Trump's advisors actually pushed him to take the call. It does seem to have been initiated from the Taiwan side, from Tsai Ing-wen.
Mm. Well, Trump's advisor, John Bolton, and his chief of staff both kind of suggested that they knew, he knew what was going on. So let's say this had been months in the works. That would suggest some larger scheme by Trump and his transition team to recalibrate U.S.-China relations. What do you think is that larger scheme?
So it's hard to say what his end game really is. I mean, he clearly wants to shake things up a bit. I wonder, though, I mean, even if I think that there's a good case to be made that the U.S. maybe ought to move away from the strategic ambiguity, which has been the basis for it, to drop the whole elaborate fiction, maybe recognize Taiwan formally as an independent state. I mean, there's a case to be made to do that, but this wasn't the right way to go about it. Even if that is your position, this a president-elect making policy with, you know, he's taking an action with clear foreign policy ramifications. And I think it would be really deeply disingenuous to hide behind this claim that he's just a private citizen here until Inauguration Day. He's usurped the prerogative of a sitting president. He's really bypassed the mechanisms that we have in place for the conduct of American foreign policy.
So, Kaiser, how do you think China is viewing Mr. Trump? Are they thinking he's a loose cannon and they'll have to allow for some individuality when he becomes president? Or will they take him at face value and act, meet power with power?
They really don't know what to make of him. That's the problem. I think the preference among Chinese elites was actually for Hillary Clinton victory, even though they regarded her as a real hawkish liberal interventionist, because they at least knew what she was about. She was the devil they knew. They don't know what to make of Trump. And I think there's a mad scramble going on in Beijing to try to make sense of this, to try to figure out who is actually, who has his ear on China-related issues. They get a lot of really mixed messages from him. Is he going to be relatively isolationist and take a posture similar to what he's taken toward Vladimir Putin and Russian moves in Eastern Europe? Or is he going to be much more hawkish, as now appears to be the case?
So if there is some kind of confrontation with China, what do you think that would look like?
My God, I mean, it's unthinkable, but...
Are we talking kind of at a basic level trade war or cyber war?
I mean, it could begin with something like that. I think, China, I mean, trade is somewhere, it's already something that Trump seems to be itching for anyway, and something that China is better prepared to fight, certainly, than, say, a cyber war or a conventional war. That, I mean, God forbid. I don't think that anyone is really thinking in that direction right now. But there are other things far short of actual war that could happen between them. I mean, there's an awful lot of trade happening between Taiwan and the mainland right now. In many ways, Taiwan is entirely dependent on its commerce with China. And if that were put into some sort of jeopardy, it's not the U.S.-China trade war that would be so worrisome as if China were to take unilateral action against trade happening with Taipei.
China analyst Kaiser Guo, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Marco.
And finally today, we've heard of fake passports and fake visas, but a whole fake American embassy? Yep, somebody did that. The U.S. State Department says a fake American embassy operated for about a decade in Accra, Ghana, charging people for fake and illegally obtained U.S. visas. The scam was made public just this past weekend. My BBC colleague Sammy Darko is covering the story in Accra. He says that reports suggest the fake embassy was run by Ghanaian and Turkish gangsters.
They rented a house. This house is what they then called their embassy, the United States of America embassy in Accra. And this is a two-story building. They have the portrait of President Obama on the wall of that particular house. And then they will fly the flag of America. And this flag, they only fly it at the time they are waiting for their clients, for the victims to come to that particular place, which they've designated as the embassy.
Now, these Ghanaian and Turkish gangsters actually, as you say, they issued real visas. I mean, they're not recognized by U.S. authorities, but they were on actual U.S. State Department documents that they created these visas. How did they get those blank documents?
That is what is still being investigated, and I'm afraid the U.S. Embassy here in Accra, they do not want to talk about this. They've been very silent on whether they got people from inside the embassy to assist them. But what we also do know is that in the time past, some people have been arrested who could create visas. And I'm told that you cannot tell the difference between the genuine and the one that they've created. So these people are very sophisticated. All they need is to be able to get a real copy, and they are able to mimic that particular copy. And so they look at the countries that many people are dying to visit or to go and work, and they produce counterfeits of such visas.
I mean, these gangsters were pretty brazen as well. They were advertising their services for these visas on billboards across Ghana. Is that true?
Exactly. They're able to get advertisements, billboards, and they do not recruit their victims only in Accra or in Ghana. They do so from neighboring countries like Cote d'Ivoire, like Togo. Yeah. So they're able to bring these people from far and near. They bring them to Accra, house them in a hotel, and then the following day, they book an appointment at this fake embassy, process them. These are people who've not been to a real embassy before, so they do not know, except that they see white people and Ghanaians working. The assumption is that they are the right place.
My colleague at the BBC, Sammy Darko, speaking with us from Accra, Ghana. Thanks very much, Sammy.
You're welcome.
And that's all from us today from the very real Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman, back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.